Hello, I'm Eamon Ryan and you're listening to Open Field, a new podcast bringing to focus a range of issues close to my own heart. I'm speaking to a range of individuals, from environmental campaigners, scientists, technologists, right through to musicians, athletes and artists that I meet in my everyday work. It is an open field, and I would love to receive your thoughts about this podcast. You can email me at eamon.ryan@aroctus.ie and find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. I was very lucky to be invited over to California earlier this year to speak at a conference which they'd organised on how California and Los Angeles is going to go green. They're the leading state now in terms of making this transition. While I was there, I met Varun Sivaram. He's the author of a new book called Taming the Sun, which is all about how we turn to solar power to run our country into the future. Hello, I'm in the hotel, LA Downtown Hotel in Los Angeles, and I'm with Varun Sivaram, who is a specialist, works for the Council of Foreign Relations in the US, works as an advisor to the mayor of New York, Mayor Cuomo, governor. but also I'm really looking to talk to him today because he's author of a book called Taming the Sun, Innovations to Harness Solar Energy and Power the Planet. So he's agreed to have a chat about that, and I hope that's something that'll maybe interest you as a listener. Varun, thanks for taking part.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to get to talk to you.
Can I ask, maybe I'm just starting by asking, just some background yourself. Where are you from and how did you get involved in solar energy?
You know, I grew up in Silicon Valley. And my first job out of high school, right before university, I worked for one of the best-funded Silicon Valley startup companies. It's called NanoSolar. They had raised almost as much money as Facebook.
Wow.
And they were convinced they were going to change the world. They had the Silicon Valley mindset of, we are going to invent our way out of this problem of global warming. And their technology was a rollable, printable solar panel.
Yeah.
I caught the solar bug at NanoSolar. I went on to study physics at Stanford, and then I went to Oxford to do my PhD in physics. And as I was studying, I continued to study solar technology, next generation coatings that were far superior than today's silicon solar panels.
Yeah.
That's how I've always approached solar power. But unfortunately, by the time I graduated, nearly every innovative solar company had gone bankrupt.
Okay.
There were actually no jobs in the solar industry in genuinely innovative companies once I entered the job market.
All right. So you were working before you went to college, in effect. You went into this company, you met them and kind of said,
I didn't know the first thing about solar, and I was a module engineer. That's the engineer that puts together the cells into a solar panel.
Yeah.
And so I learned from the ground up what these cool new technologies could do. And I always believed that, of course, the amount of time that we'd be stuck with today's technology, silicon, that's what's manufactured in mass in China, I always assumed that that time would be limited because there were far better things on the drawing board. We were coming up with them every day.
You worked in Oxford, as you said, you did your PhD there, and you were part of a lab that was looking at new materials or new types of solar. Why can you give me background on that? Explain what exactly were you doing? What were you trying to do?
Absolutely. I landed up in Oxford in one of the most exciting labs in all of physics. I didn't know it at the time, but shortly after I got there, one of my fellow graduate students discovered a material known as perovskite. Perovskite is kind of this magical material that can be not only highly efficient, meaning it converts a lot of the sunlight into electricity, but it also can be printed out of an inkjet printer. It could be flexible and lightweight. It has very cheap components. It could be even colorful or semi-transparent. You could put it as a coating on a window, you could coat a building, you could unroll it as a carpet in a desert. This perovskite was this remarkable material that we stumbled upon in Oxford, and I was lucky to get to work on it there.
Okay. So is it happening? I mean, where's the technology now? What's happening in this? I mean, we've all seen in recent years it's gone gangbusters in India and China, in America probably 3 or 4 years ago, but happening everywhere. What's at the cutting edge, or how do you see the solar market evolving from here?
Well, there are two parallel narratives. On the one hand, solar power has become the cheapest, fastest growing energy source on the planet. It attracted more investment, $160 billion last year, than any other energy source, dirty or clean. And so these are all great signs for solar. But the parallel narrative is that there's been a technology stagnation. All of that $160 billion in investment went towards silicon solar technology, which has been around for over 7 decades. And the new technologies, like perovskite that you and I are talking about, these are still largely in laboratories. You know, it's too bad that companies like NanoSolar went bankrupt and took a lot of investor money with them, because that scared new investors out of the space. Just when we really needed them, when we had this remarkable discovery of the perovskite, which, if it got adequately funded, I think could revolutionize solar. You know, my professor at Oxford, Henry Snaith, has created a spin-out company, Oxford Photovoltaics. They're the only solar startup probably in the world that's raised considerable funding in the tens of millions of dollars. And they've got a shot to bring this to market. But not many other companies are going to get that chance because investors are so scared of investing in new technology.
So you were doing that in Oxford in the later part of the last decade, was it? Or 2010, 11?
Exactly. Just in the beginning of this decade.
Just in the middle of the crash.
Yes.
Killed a lot of things. Now, it's interesting, you're looking at the market today. I mean, as you say, all the investment is in standard silicon. I heard you yesterday talking about how, you know, America is threatening to introduce higher tariffs now to try and stop that. Donald Trump in putting that in as a kind of a trade policy. How do you see that turning or working out? Are the Chinese not innovating? Are they not in their own labs kind of looking at the next generation? Or are they just sticking with the kind of manufacturing of the current model?
So China has leaped out to a dominant lead in solar. And about a decade ago, for example, starting in 2008, the Chinese government heavily subsidized its own companies to build silicon solar panels and put all of the American companies out of business, as well as many European ones. Now, however, the silicon solar companies in Asia, they're predominantly Chinese, they're just very low cost. They're very good at making cheap silicon solar panels. And so now President Trump has imposed tariffs, as you mentioned, on all solar panels, not just from China, but from Southeast Asia as well. And his hope is to bring back manufacturing to the United States. It won't happen. Because it's not that there's government support that's propping up these solar companies and that with tariffs we can convince those governments to take away their support. Rather, those companies are now just quite low cost, and we have no hope of competing even with these tariffs. I personally believe trade policy is the wrong way to stimulate innovation. However, there is a right way to do this. The United States should be investing in research, development, and demonstration of our new technologies. That's the only way the United States is going to be able to compete with China on manufacturing, for example. We have been wiped out of manufacturing, and we're not going to win if we just try and make the same thing that they make quite well. Now, you might ask, so if China makes these panels so cheaply, why do we need these new technologies? They're making quite cheap panels. The cost has dropped 80% since 2010. Well, as I argue in my book, even though solar appears cheap today, solar is not cheap enough, nor will it be cheap enough with today's technology, if we want it to become a mainstream source that really displaces fossil fuels. Because today, solar makes sense as a value proposition. There's not very much of it on the grid. But when there's a ton of solar on the grid, when at some points in the middle of the day at noontime, there's so much solar that it's flooding the grid and it's pushing out all the other generators, it becomes almost worthless. And at that point, if the value that you offer to the grid, because there's so much of it, is less than the cost, there's no reason to build more solar.
Okay.
Very quickly, I believe that we will get to the point where we deploy too much solar power with today's technology that there won't be a need for more of it. And unless the cost of solar falls even faster than the value falls, we're going to get stuck with a ceiling of solar penetration.
Can you not solve that in some ways by having a different market? So as you say, when the price is, when the sun's shining, the price goes down to zero, the investment case maybe falls. But is there ways we can ship it over distance, or is there other ways where we can use it in the home and kind of store energy, store heat, or store, like use that kind of period when it's so cheap, use it to power electric vehicles or run our heat pumps or whatever? Is it not a case to kind of use balancing as a way to manage that problem?
It's almost like you've read the book. You know, I absolutely believe that's right on point, that, you know, it's not just new technologies to make solar cheaper. That's one part of the solution. But another part of the solution is what you're calling, what you're saying, which I call systemic innovation. Systemic innovation encompasses these portfolio of approaches to move the inconvenient solar energy that we get in the middle of the day to more convenient times, for example, through storage, or to move it from one region that has a surplus to another region that has a deficit through long distance transmission, or to move it from one sector that has too much electricity, say the grid, to another sector that needs the energy at that moment, such as heating water or heating homes or charging an electric vehicle in the transportation sector. All of these are terrific ways to take a surplus commodity, electricity from solar, that we don't need in one sector and move it to another one where we do need it. And so I think that's the other half of the solution. On the one hand, you want very, very cheap solar coatings so you can have solar everywhere and it's dirt cheap. And on the other hand, you have ways of using your excess solar electricity so that you don't just throw it away.
Okay. We have a mutual friend, I found yesterday, Morgan Bazilian. Morgan used to work with me and he went on, I think when he was working in NREL, is it the National Renewables Energy Lab in Colorado. And I remember him saying at the time, I was talking to him, that they had started to get the finance model right in terms of, it was all about getting the financing, particularly for putting in rooftop solar. Ireland doesn't have any solar at the moment, practically none. We need to really ramp it up. Have you any advice on that area of financing, let's say for rooftop solar or for, how do you see what's the lessons learned in terms of how would you finance that? Or is there any things happening that you think are the really good innovation in terms of how we can make this affordable and make it financeable?
Let me first say that Ireland, even though they may not have that much solar, Ireland is a world leader when it comes to renewable energy. It is astonishing how much renewable energy Ireland has managed to integrate. I think the figure is something like 32% of its energy comes from sources like wind, predominantly wind. That's remarkable because wind is a volatile energy source, and Ireland is an isolated grid. It has some interconnections, but not many. So for a country like Ireland to integrate that much renewable energy makes it an example for other countries. Now, you asked about financial innovations. I personally believe, and I believe that I'm in line with Morgan, I believe that financial innovation is crucial to bring in trillions of dollars of capital to fund the rise of solar around the world, but that it's on track. It's already happening, and I'm very confident that the finance will come. I'm less confident about the technology and the systemic innovation as we discussed, but I'm very confident about the finance. Let me tell you a couple cool things that have happened. There are two kinds of solar that finance can support. One is centralized, large scale, we call it utility scale solar, and the other is this distributed stuff, sometimes on rooftops. On the large scale solar, there are these financial vehicles that allow the most deep-pocketed investors, pension funds, insurance funds, sovereign wealth funds, they can invest their money in a pooled vehicle of assets. This was known in its first incarnation as a yield co, and that did not do very well. But we've learned the lessons of the yield co after it crashed, and I think the second generation of this pooled vehicle will be very successful at attracting investors' money. On the distributed side, the solar industry stands to learn from other established industries that have used finance. For example, the mortgage industry and the auto industry. They use a concept called securitization. This is a concept whereby you can slice and dice loans into many small pieces, package them together, and sell them to financial markets. Of course, this can be abused, and
I remember there was a few problems with that model back in the home loans area, about 2007, that kind of came apart.
I can see you giving me a super skeptical expression, but let me tell you, apart from the crisis in 07, 08, and 09 from securitization, in general, securitization is a fundamental part of our financial system today. In many, many cases, it is used safely. And there are ways, I write in my book, that the solar industry can use securitization very safely to fund these distributed assets, solar panels on rooftops. So you as a homeowner, for example, can go and get solar on your rooftop, and the financing for that solar will come from the these public capital markets where investors invest in these securities. They bundle up many different loans, your house's roof, his house's roof, her house's roof, put them all together and they invest in a diversified portfolio, the biggest investors in the world. And thanks to that, you as a homeowner are able to put solar on your roof without putting any money up front. And that's very powerful because that can speed the rise of solar power around the world.
By your name, people would maybe realize that you've Indian family heritage before they came to America. And I know, I was talking to you yesterday, you're just back from Bangalore and Delhi last week. India is going at solar at scale. Yeah. What's your sense of that? Did you get any news about that or any sense of that when you were there last week?
Absolutely. Solar means more to India than to any country in the world, in my opinion. China may be the world leader in solar, but it's India that's staked many of its national goals on solar. Prime Minister Modi, when he came to power in 2014, set what we thought was a ridiculous target, 100 gigawatts of solar. At the time, India had something like two. And I remember the first piece I ever wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations was, this is not only an audacious goal, it is a nonsensical goal. I said, there's no way he can reach it.
Yeah.
And he surprised everybody. Yeah. India has installed a great deal of solar. They've increased their solar by more than 10 times by 2018. And this remarkable amount of solar may not get to 100 gigawatts, but it'll get close. And in doing so, India hopes to achieve several different goals. It wants to supercharge its economy, to keep it growing at rates of 6, 7, maybe even 8, 9, 10% with cheap power. It wants to bring energy access to the 300 million Indians who lack it, who lack any electricity. It wants to improve its energy security. India depends on imports of fossil fuels. All of these are reasons why India desperately wants, and of course, India wants to meet its climate change obligations under the Paris deal, and solar is the single largest component of that environmental commitment. So solar means more to India than I think any other country in the world.
Okay. I'm going to jump now, and I'm jumping across continents and countries, but I can't leave this be without asking the question that everyone in Ireland would be interested in, is what you make of your president here, President Trump. Is he going to stop this revolution, or is he a real threat to it, or are people just ignoring him and proceeding anyway? What's the effect of Donald Trump in this revolution?
He is a real threat to it, but possibly not in the way that you might think. A lot of people might say, oh, Donald Trump is a threat to solar because he'll stop deploying solar at home. You know, the cost of solar will continue to fall around the world, and solar will continue to be deployed around the world. The United States is one small market among many different markets. Progress against climate change will continue, even if the United States stops installing solar at a rapid clip. But there are two things I worry about that Donald Trump could really upend. And they're the two kinds of innovation that I'm most worried about, technological innovation and systemic innovation. On the technology front, President Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama, promised the world that he would double U.S. investment in research and development for energy technologies. The U.S. is the biggest funder at $6.4 billion a year of energy innovation. And 20 countries around the world pledged to double their funding behind the lead of President Obama. President Trump not only a step back from this, he has proposed cutting our investment by half, not doubling it. That would be catastrophic. The United States not only would lose its leadership in energy innovation, but it would set back the world's efforts to develop the new technologies we need. And the second thing that President Trump is going to set back is systemic innovation. See, I told you, it's not that useful for the United States to deploy solar just so that the totals of solar go up, but it is useful for the United States to demonstrate to the world how to integrate a lot of solar. You know, you and I are here in California. Mm-hmm. California has an enormous penetration of solar power on its grid, greater than 10, probably greater than 15% of its electricity comes from solar energy. Now, if California and the rest of the country can demonstrate to the world how to effectively build a flexible system with many of the strategies we talked about, electric vehicle charging, space and water heating, etc., then they could help the world build a template for how to build more solar. Now, Ireland is taking the lead on doing this, for example, with wind, how to integrate a lot of intermittent wind. It's up to the United States to demonstrate systemic innovation to the world when it comes to solar. And I'm very worried that President Trump is going to prevent us from being that beacon on a hill that we should be.
A final question for you is, and I suppose this, your solar research and your thinking and your book and the whole world you're involved in this area is important, is one of the important ways in which we can tackle climate change, one of the big challenge, huge systemic challenges we faced. What's your, are you optimistic that we're going to, I know this is a very broad and big question, but from the work you're doing both in the political system as well as in the research energy system, Are you pessimistic or optimistic in terms of we'll make the sort of reductions we need to make to meet the Paris Climate Agreement?
You know, I believe I personally am an optimist, but I don't think anybody at this conference here in Los Angeles believes I'm an optimist. I think they all think I'm a pessimist. And that's because of the syndrome I'm noticing, you may have noticed it as well, of rampant, unrealistic optimism, of what I call triumphalism. Everybody here thinks we've solved the problem, that we are on the right track, that money is flowing into solar and wind, and that we are, you know, just going to inevitably solve climate change. We are nowhere close to solving climate change. I believe that solar energy could provide a majority of humanity's energy needs sometime this century. But I don't think we're on track to do that. I'm an optimist that humanity will figure it out, but I think there are serious policy steps we must take. There are serious investments that must be made by the private sector. I think all of this is urgent, exigent, for us to get there. So yes, I'm optimistic. But by the way, there's so much more. In addition to solar power, we need to figure out how to remove carbon dioxide from the air. We need to figure out how to resuscitate the nuclear industry. We need to figure out how to make clean fuels, some of which can come from solar energy. But there's so many things we must do. We must plant new forests. We must reduce other climate warming gases than carbon dioxide, like methane and like hydrofluorocarbons. There are so many things we must do, but I'm optimistic that not only my country, but other countries like yours will be able to come together and do it when, you know, when the time demands, and I think that time is now.
Listen, I very much appreciate you taking part, Vernon. I hope you're right. I think you are right. I think we have the potential to do it. It's a matter of getting out and doing it. And I really appreciate your contribution in that and your willingness to talk to me today.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Field. Please let me know what you think by emailing me at eamon.ryan@arachthus.ie, or you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Benedict Schlepper-Conley and Anna Conlon. The theme music is by Benedict Schlepper-Conley. You can always find the latest edition of Open Field on my website eamonryan.ie or on all main podcasting platforms. Bye for now.